started thinking about a few things.
Let me have three more back.
All right. Well, one thing that won't intrude on what Jim is going to ask is if you were to name five people that you would think would be absolutely essential for the Reagan oral history here, who would you name?
Well, Jim Baker. Nancy Reagan.
We wrote her.
Well, not because he had the closeness to events in a way that the last two people have, but I get Don Regan down here. He'd give you another perspective on this. Don Regan.
Yes, he's been here.
And probably Mike Deaver.
He's hard to get, isn't he?
Well, I don't know. I bet you he'd come if you talk to him now.
Who
he's in Washington.
Who's a good channel? We've tried very hard to get him, but we haven't had anybody who was close to him.
Well, how recently have you tried to get him?
Oh, about 4 months ago.
Well, I just try again if I can't think of that. I don't know offhand who would be a better channel than any of which we might already be trying, but he's changed a lot of his attitude about all this in the last few months, anyway. So I'd try him again. Who else? Well, there are a lot of other people you could get, but I don't know whether they would speak as frankly as the ones I mentioned. I mean, even Baker would speak fairly frankly on this kind of a subject at this point. Well, I can't come up with another one who would fit quite into that crowd. I mean, you can get Meese, but Meese probably won't be very frank about very much.
He agreed to come, but then he kept getting, I suppose, legitimate conflicts.
Yeah. Would be good to get maybe one of his old financial backers from California, but most, I'm pretty sure they're either Justin Dart's dead, and Holmes Tuttle is probably, if not dead, not quite with it. And they would be the two main men.
William Frank Smith is in that area.
No, he was always sort of the lawyer for the rest of them. He which made him some money, but he wasn't in their league quite. He hung around with them, but he was the lawyer. You know, this maybe one you haven't thought of, at least. There's a woman named Nancy Reynolds, who by the time I met them all, she'd already worked for them quite a while. She was always until she retired, and she wasn't forced to, which was amazing, she was Mrs. Reagan's closest confidant. She was her aide and traveled everywhere with her. And she retired with her head still on her shoulders. Mm-hmm. And she's in Washington. She has a consulting firm with another woman with, Duffy's wife, you know, the head of Massachusetts University, who used to be head of...
Wexford Hamburg.
Yeah, that's right. She's in business with that.
Do you ever have anything to do with a fellow named Hank Colton, who said he was the contact point between Mike Deaver and Nancy Reagan on the astrology thing?
Well, I think I knew who he was, but really have anything to do with it.
Well, these are good names. We pursue them.
Well, first of all, I've had four bites. First of all, I want to say I admire your Pennsylvania Philadelphia accent. I don't have it myself, but I recognize one when I see it.
Is that
amazing,
what it is?
Amazing gift. I thought I was almost in the room.
I see.
I wonder if you would sort of inform us or educate us about how you got acquainted with and associated with Ronald Reagan, and how you started out and sort of walked us through your first association and what you saw and what you did and what your experiences were from taking it from the first. How did you get to know him or get associated with him?
Well, I had actually met him in 1966 when he was running for governor. And I was with Nixon at that time, traveling around, and we went to California quite a lot for congressional candidates, but beyond that, of course, Bob Finch was running for lieutenant governor, and we did some things for him, too. And in the process of all that, now and then we'd bump into Reagan, or certainly at these Finch events, he often was at those. And so I actually, you know, I met him back then to the degree that, you know, when we'd meet on other occasions, we'd both remember who each other were. You know? Of course, that was no problem for me. He was governor then. But I met him then. You know, it's hard sometimes to recollect your first impression of anybody, but Reagan, I think pretty uniformly, always came across to people when they first met him as something different from what they'd heard of him. If what your experience had been is you'd seen him make speeches in public, and I remembered seeing him give the Goldwater speech in 64, and then you were confronted with him, you'd say to yourself, well, this is not the same man that I thought it was. I thought he was. Far more personable, pragmatic, down-to-earth, nicer person.
than
you would have expected from this person who was up here discussing the fine points of what was proper philosophy and what wasn't, mm-hmm. And ready, according to his oratory, to accept results that might not be, for the moment, in the best interest of the majority of people for some broader philosophical good. Many people thought that if they had only seen Reagan give speeches, that he also was sort of a tough person, which, of course, the minute you met him, you didn't feel that way either. So, you know, later on I'd make use of that a lot because you could have confidence in it. When I remember first introducing him to Jacob Javits, and Javits went away, as everybody else did, you know. You don't want to let this go on too long, but I mean, at least for a while, I walked away, my God, he's a wonderful person. And of course, he knew a lot of people that Jack knew out in Hollywood, and they were good friends, and they were good friends of Reagan's. And, so that's when I met him. And while he was governor, we didn't really see much of each other. I left the White House at the end of 1969 and went up to the Kennedy Institute for a while, and then came back and practiced. Now, in the early 70s, after the 72 election, of course, people then got interested in who was going to run the next time. As Watergate had just commenced. But, you know, obviously Nixon couldn't run again. And so those of us who had had any experience in nominating people began to be found or talked to by various people who were interested in running. I talked a lot with Rockefeller during that period at his request. And the other thing that had changed is we now had, as of the, because of the reforms that the Democrats had undertaken, which had affected us too out in the states, we now had a whole lot of primaries in the system. Not as many as we ultimately got, but quite a few. You know, in Rockefeller's case, he wasn't going to have to just go back to people who had rejected him in 64, who were too conservative, who ran the party, who had all these primaries. And Agnew talked to me in that period. Both of those dried up for obvious different reasons. Agnew's was very obvious. He had to resign the office. And Rockefeller, we had a grave, well, we weren't fighting about it, but I thought it was a terrible mistake for him to resign the governorship, as he did. I mean, some way or another, he thought that if he could just get off the stage for a little while, that would help some way. And yet, by getting off the stage, he was giving up a powerful, influence that he had. So we didn't agree on that, but that wasn't so bad. Then the matter came up of whether he should accept the vice presidency. And I was strongly against that. If he wanted to run for president. You know, fine if you don't. I was strongly against that, and I figured after he took it, there wasn't any. I mean, he thought, somebody, I think I know who, but I'm not sure, but I mean, I don't know this for a fact, but some people he trusted that I know of, I think were telling him that they were very close to Ford, that Ford had already made up his mind he wasn't going to run, and that if he'd just be the vice president, why... Ford would ultimately announce this and there it would be for him, you know. Once you're in that office and you do a few things, especially if you are in this peculiar position Ford was in, that you've never earned it yourself and you've done a few things and are somewhat controversial, you go out and run again. Whatever you think coming in. I mean, it's a personal affront to you that things that you know were so well designed to do good are being interpreted as bad. And it, even if you can handle your own ego once you get to be president, you feel responsible to go out and support what you've been doing, not just give up. That's an admission that your adversaries were right. So I don't think anybody was being... was lying to Rockefeller, but that's just not the way it goes. And
was Lynn Nofziger working at the time with Reagan?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you were Rockefeller?
Well, I wasn't working with him. We were just talking. I wasn't working with anybody. We had not gotten married. we were having a few casual dates, so. Now, somewhere, well, actually in May, maybe, of, no, it was earlier than this, I guess. But anyway, it was April or March or somewhere in there, 74. Why some people I knew from California called on me and wanted me to come out to California to, you know, sit around with a few of them and Reagan. So I said, fine, I'll do that too. So I went out, and the subject of discussion got around to Nixon. Strangely, out there anyway, why everybody thought, this was true in other parts of the country too, but everybody thought Nixon was going to some way survive this Watergate. So that, you know, that was the operative fact about planning for 76. And so I told him, no, he wasn't going to survive it. He would be out of there by fall, and one way or another. And that nobody needed to necessarily change their plans because of that, because we'd have a Ford would be president, but he'd be a unique incumbent. Ordinarily, there's a lot of sympathy for somebody who's vice president who, you know, has the job come to him because of the circumstances of the death of the president. Ford would get some because of the circumstances that he was in, but that wouldn't last too long. And that now that we had all these primaries, an incumbent was not insulated from challenge. I said at the time, I don't think this is good, but what this system does, it opens up the incumbent to have to fight to keep his own nomination if there's enough controversy about his stewardship. And so that's another difference. And so in other words, even though that's what's going to happen, don't think that ends anything. And I told others that too. Well, that's what happened, and I guess I grew in credibility. As
were you identified as a Nixon person today?
Well, I was. Yeah, that's. Yeah. Whatever that meant.
I noticed you said this morning that you never asked Reagan whether he was running or not. When you were asked to come out to talk about these things, were these some of the seniors of kitchen cabinet group?
Well, it was Meese and Deaver and at that time a guy named Bob Walker, who I'd worked mm-hmm. with for a while under Nixon, who I knew. And, well, Jim Lake at the time was their California representative. I'd only met him, I'd met him because we'd campaigned in 66, Nixon and I, in Bob Mathias's congressional district, and I'd met him on that, but I didn't really know him. But they were the people there. Jeffrey Bell, who I didn't know, he'd worked in the speech writing department in Nixon. But it was that group.
How did Reagan behave in this group? Was he present?
Well, we talked a lot, and then we went up to his house. And, you know, I remember that day, you know, I looked at him, and I thought, my God, he looks a lot older up close than I remember him now. This is 74. And I thought to myself, you know, maybe.
Too late.
Yeah. But we went ahead and we had this discussion up at his house. You know, it was the funniest thing because after he left the governorship, you know, this is now 75, he looked great again. But I remember thinking that day, I wonder if this is really feasible because as you get up this close to him. and it must be, you know, irretrievable. But it wasn't. He got out of the governorship, he spent a little time off, and he looked fantastic.
You know Bert Smith, he was his doctor.
Yes,
his explanation is that Nixon or Reagan came to him on something, I can't remember, blood pressure or whatever it was, and he told Reagan, you can handle this and you'll get rid of it, but not if you seek the presidency. And Reagan persisted, but I wondered whether
people were always assuming Reagan would come under pressure or, you know, be pressured by various things, and it was a remarkable thing how well he could avoid pressure. And he did. I mean, he was the oldest man to be, for the first time, elected the presidency in there for 8 years. And, you know, again, Nixon looked, well, he had the Watergate, but he looked pretty, he grew older. Carter looked a lot worse, leaving and coming, that was only 4 years. Johnson, my goodness. Everybody usually. Reagan, he spent 8 years there. He didn't look any worse to me when he left than when he arrived. And that was years in his 70s.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Did you feel like, in any way, as though you were an outsider in that group? One person who spoke to us talked about there being a cocoon, the California Mafia thrown around Reagan in his first year, in his first months in the presidency after he was elected.
Well, maybe to a degree. I mean, the people there, like Meeson, Bieber, and, well, at that time when I first went out, Pete Hannaford was there, and he, after the first campaign, he left and went out into other endeavors. But they'd been around Reagan. There'd always been a group around. Of course, there always is a group around Reagan. Outsider, yeah. I mean, I didn't know them or him the way they all knew each other. But, you know, for what I was looked to do, there wasn't a lot of tampering going to go on about it. And that's what is, you know, that's what you have to worry about. I mean, Reagan, again, he was very malleable. He wanted the advice. He'd take it. I was talking this morning about him being an actor and forming these habits there. It was true that if the director had come in one day and said, well, you got to play this soon in this scene in the nude, he would have said no. So there were limits. But as long as you stayed within him, you were trusted to give advice and he'd take it. And, you know, in terms of running a campaign, you don't often find that pure a situation. So sure, there were people around him, but they weren't obstructionists in terms of what I was doing. They weren't there to second-guess you or try to convince him of something else. They had their own... And Meese, in the first one anyway, was not there. Even though he was on the staff, he left. He didn't think any of this would ever go anywhere, so he got himself a job. So he wasn't around in 75 and 6. So it was really just Bieber and Hannaford at that time.
Meese once said that Reagan was malleable and willing to compromise on everything except three issues: anti-communism, strong defense, and cut taxes. Did you find that in the early period or not?
In the early period?
When you talked to him then?
Well, when I first met him, yeah, he was anti-communist. But when I first met him, one of the problems was he was going around making speeches about how we were 5 minutes to midnight and the country was just going to go to hell in a handbasket. And we had to make up this budget deficit. And when pressed about that, and as a last alternative, he'd say we'd have to raise taxes, which was the worst of all worlds, all that speech. No, I didn't feel the tax one was. And on he wasn't anti-communist. What was the other one?
Strong defense.
Oh, strong defense. Yeah, he was strong on that. But, I mean, the two things were linked. And as, you know, to his credit, when he recognized that Gorbachev was different, he went and embraced that. And so I don't, he wasn't unmalleable about that either. And he would be cutting the defense, allowing that to happen. And the taxes, my God, you know, he'd run for governor in 66 on a pledge that they would not raise taxes. He got in, and according to him, that's what he said about it, he hadn't realized how badly off the state was, even though he'd been out there campaigning. It was in terrible shape. But once he realized that, they raised taxes.
He said you could hear the concrete cracking around him for breaking his promises.
And when he, you know, after he cut taxes at the federal level, as you recall, we used to do revenue enhancements.
Right.
So I didn't find him unmalleable even on those issues.
Reading a book in process about saving books now being produced, and one of the things I knew, but I had emphasized to me in a way that together with the strong defense business, he also had a long-term and, is visceral the right word at any rate, deeply in him, abhorrence of nuclear war. That went back to episodes quoted even in his, during the war when he was in Hollywood, and that's a part of the rooting it on down to SDI.
Yeah. Well, I'd say this, I never worried, you know, again, as it became clearer and clearer that Reagan might even become president, you heard more and more shrillness, people saying, my God, that man's crazy, and he is so doctrinaire, he might actually push the button, and, you know. And, I mean, these weren't just people who hated him, there was some of that, but, I mean, these were people who really worried about that. And I knew him. And I never worried about that a bit. Again, that would be asking him to play the scene in the nude. That's outside the limits. And I never had any worry about that. Now, I'm not trying to dump on Nixon here. Nixon, if cornered and thought there's no alternative, and I didn't stay awake night, sleep, you know, worrying about this either. I don't mean to say that. But he could have done it. It would not have been easy. It would not have been an easy thing to do. I mean, for him. But I mean,
Nixon would not have differed from many other presidents.
That's right. That's right. But Reagan, there was no chance. If we got attacked first, first thing he'd do is say, "Well, you know, can't we tell him to stop?"
Cut.
Yeah, that's right.
Shoot it again. Right.
Well, he said he started that in college, didn't he, Bill? He said when they sat around in his college class and were thinking about enlisting or getting drafted, he said some of his friends said they would never be responsible for dropping a bomb on civilians.
This is another thing out of this. This is off the track a little, but goes back to your first impressions of him and the combination of amiability and passivity. That's what I get from this reading of this book. And the passivity is extends not only to what the Tower Commission calls management style involved in Iran-Contra, but also I hadn't realized in a certain way, the personal relations to staff and so forth, that although amiable and in some ways a wonderful boss, you don't expect to get, there's a lot of records of people disappointed. Not thanked, not appreciated, not patted on the back, so that the amiability does not extend to taking an initiative of...
Well, it is just what it is. It's amiability. It's nothing more. But very often, especially in politics, amiability is confused with loyalty. And there are two different concepts, and he wasn't necessarily very loyal in the way that people expected him to be to a lot of people that worked for him. But again, you know, you don't have any assurances of any. Politics is not fair. If you expect it to be fair, in your view of what's fair, you will get out of it very quickly. It's a situation where somebody is trying to achieve power at some level or another. And what you have to agree, if you're going to get involved in this to help them, is that you will help them. That's what you agree to. As you go higher in it, at higher levels, it does become a strange kind of marriage. It's a loveless marriage. You know each other the way you would know your wife. Maybe better. I mean, the candidate and whoever is close.
But there ain't no love in it.
No, it wasn't a union that was derived from love. People assume that's what it must be, that if you work for somebody, you must love them in some kind of way, or think they are incapable of wrong, or, you know, so strongly believe in what they're going to do that you'll put yourself in. It isn't that way. The best you can say to yourself is what you're doing is better than what others are doing. And that's, you know, the truth to you. If that ever stops, then you've got a problem. But that's what you do. And there isn't loyalty in this. I mean, your candidate, your wife, or your spouse, is off every day dilly-dallying with people, other people, who are trying to convince them of things that you don't want them to, you know, to do, and that are trying to often drive a wedge between the two of you. But you see, in this strange marriage, he gets to do that. You don't.
You generalize this to politics in general, but about Reagan specifically, on the one hand, you test this perception against you, which this other book is. On the one hand, there isn't a strong drive for power at the level of so many people in politics, presumably Nixon, but it would be, you know, you really want it badly. You want to have it. You don't get that. On the other hand, the thing that you do get in an old-fashioned politics, with Billy Meehan and his company, kind of tribal loyalty. These are our boys and those are not.
That's true.
You don't get that in as I read this in Reagan either.
No,
he doesn't sharply say, these are people who were with me, and we at Agincourt, and we're going to stick together.
No, no.
Band of brothers. There's none of that.
No.
Not that.
No. You know, yes, Reagan was a different, he wasn't, so overcome by his desire for power to do this. But I'll tell you this, for anybody to do this, to run for president, it may look as though it's sort of an interesting thing to do from the outside, but it's a terrible thing to do with your life, and you know that. By the time you get very close to it, and if you don't, you know it the minute you step over the line and start running, and it's no fun. So you've got to have something to keep you going, and so yes, sometimes it's this tremendous desire for power.
In Reagan's case, is it desire for power or
no.
The applause, the stage, the performance?
Well, I would be severely oversimplifying it to say to play this role, but that would be the short way to do it, because it was more than that. It was a status. It was an acceptance. But it wasn't the power so much.
On this question of passivity, did Ronald Reagan give instructions to people around him?
Never. Well, now I take that back. I mean, he might... Well, even this would be very little, but I mean, if he, if he wanted something, of a personal nature, he'd ask for it. But I mean, that's not an instruction, and he certainly never did over anything substantive. The only thing that would bother him, that's right, entirely different. The only thing that would bother him is if he would accept this if you went and talked to him about it and went through this. The only thing he'd argue with you about is being out campaigning for more than 2 weeks at a time. he would demand, and you, if you were going to do more than that, you had to justify it, that he be given 3 or 4 days off after 2 weeks. And actually, he was sort of right about that. You see, this wasn't that he was just lazy. He would begin, again, to look tired, to run down a little bit, and he knew that about himself. And he didn't want to be out there in public doing less than his best in terms of what's people's perception of him. And he'd give him 2 or 3 days, and he'd be fine again. But that was really why that was. People would think, you know, who worked for him before, well, he's lazy. Well, that isn't it. He had such a good understanding, for, again, from probably being in the acting business, of how far he could go, you know, how long he could keep this up at this level. And he was unwilling to be less than that.
If he got a speech draft, would he do lots of editing?
Well, he wouldn't change the thrust of it, the substance of it. He'd do some things to tailor it to himself, but they were not substantive changes ever. You know, if you read any of his speeches, the speeches he gave, you will never feel by reading them that they were very good speeches. But then if you had a videotape of him doing it, you think, wow, that was a pretty good speech. And you see, most of what he was good at was it was sort of conveying a sort of confidence, a sort of on other occasions a kind of empathy for some things. But it wasn't the words. It was never the words. So people who would write for him, you know, as long as they got the concepts straight and the principles straight, and they would remain that sort of the way they were. But he would, his style was really what he was selling. And if you haven't done it, go read some of the speeches and you'll find, God, that's not much of a speech. Well, that's somebody gives this, you look a little foolish.
For the 76 campaign, where would some of the important things have come from, for instance, position on the Panama Canal?
Well, that was an interesting thing. We were in the position where we couldn't, we didn't feel, openly criticize Ford for much. Because, again, we're a small party, and once, and we, again, even in 76, excuse me, we'd been through a big party split in 64, then we'd had the Watergate. And the people who were still loyal to the party weren't going to, you know, put up with too much, you know, just bare-fisted combat here. But we needed to find some way to take advantage of what we assumed and knew, and it was under the surface a bit in the polls, was true of people's perception of Ford, and that was they liked him. Nice guy. But they didn't really think he was up to the job. That he didn't, you know, he was not smart enough or attentive enough or something. And they didn't know him well enough to say which it was, or they didn't know of any specific examples of it, but there was a feeling of that. So we started into the Panama Canal by virtue of alleging, you know, here was Ford out saying that he, because a lot of people were interested, we weren't raising the issue yet, but people were asking what was going to happen to the Panama Canal there. And he was out making statements about how he was never going to give it away and all this stuff. Well, meanwhile, at the same time he was doing that, his ambassador to Panama was up on the hill testifying in closed session that we were going to have to go through with this treaty and give back this canal. So we exposed this. And we didn't say, well, Ford's lying. We said, well, this is sort of proof that Ford doesn't always know what's going on in his own administration. He's an honest man. And we started out with that. And, of course, they kicked that. They helped us because they blew that around for a while. And the ambassador said, well, he was under orders to do this, and Ford said, well, who ordered you to do that? So, well, that came from the National Security Council. They weren't talking to each other, but the press was in here doing this. So, you know, then we just went out there and stated our position that we weren't going to give it up. And, but it was really what was helping us about it. It was an illustration. Not that Ford was a bad person, not that he was a liar, but again, that he was sort of incompetent.
So that really did emerge from campaign strategists.
That's right. In that way.
I want to borrow your filmmaking analogy and ask you who, during these periods, was doing the directing? I'm assuming.
Well, when he was running in 76 and while I was there in 80, it was me. And later on, it was Jim Baker at the White House. And then it fell to Don Regan, but he wasn't very experienced at this kind of directing. And he got into difficulty about it. But that's how it was.
Could you take us back to 76? You pretty much walked us up to that point, and then give us a picture of what you were doing and what he was doing to prepare up through 80. What was going on in that?
I mean, between 76 and 80?
Between 76 and
80. Well, we had put together, you know, in 76, of course, we ran at this without any open support out of the regular party, understandably, because they had to support the president. They had no, some might have wished to do different, but they couldn't. So to run in all these primaries and carry on the effort in non-primary states, we'd had to go outside of the regular structure and find new people. In many states, there were plenty of people who wished to be for Reagan, and you had to be a little careful how wild you got. You know, there are people. Other places, you know, it was easier because maybe you didn't have quite as many to choose from, but they were more close to the regular identity of the party. But anyway, we wound up out of that with a whole lot of people that, you know, had just fought this nomination, and not one of them was the county chairman somewhere, or the certainly not the state chairman or the national committee people. But we had them all together. They were together because of Reagan, part of the Republican Party that was Reagan's. So we didn't want to just get rid of them, so we set up a political action committee, had meetings every 3 months. I didn't go to all of them. In various parts of the country to gather these people together and keep them going. And at the same time, we knew that when we got to 79 and 80, this time we could get a lot of people out of the party. So we began, even before that, to begin to, you know, here in some states, our state leadership had been at loggerheads because of this race in 76 with the regulars. There's some animosity there. So we began to get some of our people used to the idea, this time we're going to have some of these people in here, and pretty early, and, you know, this is all for Reagan, so we have to do this. And, you know, got people used to that. So we started out in 79 with a pretty powerful, you know, already existing, and now supplemented by, you know, people from the regular structure organization, which we'd already been through the cost and effort to produce 4 years earlier, and was far stronger and bigger than anybody else's. So during the intervening time, that's what I did a lot of.
Were you in California?
No, I was still in Washington, but, you know, I was practicing law, but I mean, you didn't, you know, you talk to people. I mean, people would call you to see what they ought to be doing, and you'd have conversations with them, and you'd be able to get them around to this, that this is going to be a little different this time. A few cases, we had to get rid of people who were strongly for us because they couldn't adapt to this. There's a fellow up in Michigan named Jack Wellborn, who was our state chairman. He was a state senator, and he got into such a match with the governor there that I told him he couldn't do that because the governor might, we were going to be running even in the fall, if not before, with the governor right with us. So he had to stop that if he was going to be with us. He didn't stop, so I had to fire him one day. But Milliken was impressed with that, so but so we had a few like that. But Now, Reagan, all he did really was stay alive. He went around doing his play for pay speeches, making some money.
Radio,
that's
firing
right.
Firing line.
That's right.
Panama Canal debate. Right. That was great.
But, you know, there wasn't much to do, really. The first couple of years for Reagan, you know, you didn't want to get in there too fast, getting after Carter. After a while, you can see how it's going, and you did, and certainly by the time a year and a half to 2 years was up, you could, along with everybody else, get after Carter. So he didn't started doing that.
You didn't have to brief him on things, did you?
Not on a regular basis. We saw each other quite a few times in that intervening period, but not on a regular basis.
What did you talk about when you saw each other?
Well, I'd mainly talk to him about, the political situation, how it was coming, and, you know, how it... But that was a pretty, there were no great surprises in any of that. I mean, I told him when Carter first got elected, Carter was not prepared for this. He wasn't going to be popular. Unless he was one hell of a guy, he wasn't going to be able to easily survive it. He had no friends in Washington. By most of them. And that, the first thing Carter did when he came into office, which was no big national problem, but I mean, the first thing he did was he meddled with the water projects, which had taken five, by some accounts, 8 years in Congress to put together. And here's this new guy who comes in here and rips it all. This had not been an easy thing to structure, and this guy comes in and says, this costs too much money.
You're referring to Carter as an outsider to Reagan.
Yes. No, we were outsiders too. But, as a matter of fact, in 76, we started running, not against Ford again, we couldn't do that. But we started talking about Washington. Now, there was no poll that said Washington was any problem, but you knew it was. People's minds. And we were running like hell on that. Now, the trouble was, then Carter picked up on it later. But you see, you have to do what you are. We were outsiders, so was he. But we knew we were outsiders, so we weren't going to make it by saying, well, we know this place. We don't. So our approach was, well, since we've never been there, maybe we can stick it out. And he picked up on it. Now, it happened in the Republican Party after Ford began to do a little better. That wasn't as saleable. Democratic Party, it was wildly saleable. And I think, our own feeling was it was a lot harder to get nominated in 76 than it was to get elected. We thought we could have gotten elected. Easier than we had, in spite of the trouble in the party. Because, same thing. We had, as a matter of which outsider you wanted, and we thought they'd take us. Better style, better everything. I mean, people didn't like Carter even when he was young. In the North, he was too much of a Baptist minister for all the traditional Democrats, the white-collar Democrats. I mean, the white, blue-collar Democrats, ethnic people. Their grandmothers had told them for years never to trust a man. And again, I think the Republicans could have taken advantage of that, except they didn't choose to run up there.
When you talk to him about what was happening or might happen with Carter, did he press you on questions?
No, look at it. He was not the questioning kind, but he was not a stupid man either. Sometimes I guess you should say that because people get the impression he's he wasn't stupid. He would pick up everything you gave him, and he'd do it well, even if he didn't have much depth on the thing, on whatever it was. He'd look his worst when he was trying to answer something or do something nobody had told him. But if you told him, he grasped it, he knew it, he had a sense of what the parameters were, and without knowing anything more than what you told him, he had good instincts about where to stop and what to do. And he picked that all up just in the conversation. He didn't like to have it. Nixon, you had to write everything down for Nixon. You could have a good conversation with him. But, you know, to do anything, you know, even then he'd say, well, write that down. He'd have to study it. Reagan, he didn't want to read it. He picked this all up just from talking.
So
he wanted to stick with it.
One of your predecessors said he didn't particularly like halls. He didn't like to sit around.
Well, it wasn't that. He didn't have that kind of interest. Most people were running for office, you know, actually wish they were politicians. Now, there's a difference. I mean, many people who are politicians wish they could run for office. But so they enjoy the company of pals. Reagan, if you just sat around and talked to Reagan, or, and, you know, the conversation took its natural course, you'd never discuss politics. I mean, he had a lot of other interests. He discussed baseball with him, and he certainly the movies, past, present, or future. Almost anything else. What he read in the paper that day. That wasn't on the front. That wasn't news. It was some interesting.
How much did he read?
Not too much. Well, I really think what... I don't have evidence to back this up, but I think with the paper, what he did, he maybe looked at the entertainment section before the sports section, but maybe not. And he might look then, if he saw some interesting article on health, or, you know, or something else, but he wouldn't be in there reading the headline of what was the biggest news story in the world first, any day, most likely. Now you may think that's bad, but there's a certain balance to that. Yeah.
How did the education proceed to Reagan on the issues? Like you say, during this period between 76 and 80, and you say once somebody speaks to Reagan, that he has a good grasp on that information. Then it seems to me that access to him, discussing what issues, becomes extraordinarily important.
Well, it's not only access, but it's some preparation to say, now this is important and this is maybe something we ought to do here. You can give him access to all kinds of people, but you don't have to worry about this. Well, you do sometimes. But if it's somebody you trust and you give him access and they tell him something stupid, you may believe it. But ordinarily, if it's some new person who's never seen before and you give him access, you don't have to worry about him, you know, listening, because you didn't tell them to.
Who controlled it between 76 and 80, the kind of the people that saw
well,
him? And,
Deaver did, mainly, but we were in close contact about that. So Deaver did well at that. I mean, you see, most campaigns, you're getting to the point, are, all, among other things, they're a struggle inside for the man's mind. Well, there's no struggle about Reagan's mind. There weren't people just trying to peddle their own ideas that they were right around them. I was supposed to tell him what the political situation was and what he should do relative to that and how he should behave and who he should call and when and all that. And in between 76 and 80, and he, well, at least 79 till we started running again. You know, it was accepted that what he was going to do was do his speeches and you know, make some money, and we weren't going to be trying to fill him up with issue stuff at this point. And starting in 79, though, we did begin to start working out the issues. But that was in preparation for his next announcement. But, you know, before you announce, you don't really have to get into the issues except where you want to and when you want to. After you announce, then you're responsible for everything. So you can be asked anything, you have to answer. Before you announce, you can say, well, I don't want to answer. Who cares?
So when they did brief him during that period, it would be more one-on-one or more orally. They wouldn't give him, like you say, a memo or something that he wouldn't want to read.
Right. The other thing he'd pick up very well on, if indeed the people in the room were capable of doing this, but before he'd have a press conference, you know, you can anticipate most questions you can get. And, you know, if you gave him some imaginative way to answer a question, he'd be very grateful, and he'd remember it fully. I mean, he'd never follow that up if he heard it.
It was scripted.
Yeah, well, again, script, but I mean, I'm saying he didn't really need a cue card for that. He would pick up a lot of this stuff out of the air. Very quick.
You never leaned toward the strategy that one of the speakers was just as far as press conferences, after he became president, the greatest asset was just his smiling face. This person said that with briefings for press conferences, you didn't try to give them too much. You hoped to.
Well, you never. It depends on what you mean. We had, I forced this just for really not for him, but so everybody else who was asked, and since he didn't always make himself available for this, everybody else in the organization often got asked what his position was on this or thus. Say, well, go talk to the candidate, and the guy will say, well, what do you mean? I can't get to him. So it's better to have every. So we wrote up an issue book, and we passed it around everybody and said, well, this has got the answer to all the questions. So if you get a question, don't tell me what it. Tell him you'll answer it. It's in here. He wouldn't use it, and I wasn't expecting it, but we had one. So, you know, if you're saying, well, did we differ, this gentleman that you're referring to, and I'm trying to put a whole lot of detail into his mind, no, because you couldn't do that. But, again, most questions do not require a whole lot of detail to both answer them and answer them in a way that person thinks they've got an answer, not just an evasion. And he would do that.
Who was the gatekeeper of the issue?
Well, that was Marty Anderson on both occasions.
And there was no competition here. You came from...
Not for me. I picked
parties.
Marty Anderson? No, we didn't come from a different party.
It was a different wing of the party, but your connection did
not really. Well, no, Marty Anderson worked for Nixon, okay. Too. That's where I got him. Baby doctor. He was a doctor.
Was it the deeper service director?
No, I brought him in myself. Pardon?
The deeper worked for Reagan continuously?
Yeah.
No breaks?
No breaks. You know, what happened...
Martin Anderson tells a story about him being fired.
Mm-hmm. That's right. In 79,
okay.
But all through this period, he was here. See, what had happened, frankly, was that Reagan was winding down as governor, and the expectation had been that Holmes Tuttle and Justin Dart, and they had actually, I think, said this to him, that they'd put him on some boards, and that's how he, you know, survived thereafter. Well, the Watergate was in process here and a few other things, and they had to come back and say there weren't any boards to run. And so it was then that he had to figure out what the devil he was going to do. So Deaver and Hannaford, who had planned to start their own PR business, came to him, and they put together a plan for him to do a radio show and then to be marketed, giving speeches, and that's what he did. And they handled him doing that all through these years. And again, you know, up till the end of 75 when he announced he had to give this up for the duration, and then he picked it up again. They handled it all.
And what was the issue in 79 of which he was?
Well, he just happened to be in the middle of a larger issue. I mean, nobody really intended it, you know, it didn't get started as an endeavor to fire Dieter. We were having some internal jousting really over the matter. About it, how much Reagan was going to get into this time, and how much he wasn't. I stupidly felt that it would be nicer if, you know, because I thought he probably, you know, we could probably get him elected this time, for sure. If, you know, and he, and actually, frankly, he'd made, from where he was when I first met him, by the time we stopped in 76, he'd grown in his ability to both have confidence and do this tremendous amount. Now, he was far from perfect, but he made a lot of progress through this. And I sort of expected we'd continue to do this. I mean, these campaigns have to also be sort of educational, I thought. But we got going in 79, and the education sort of stopped, and I was always objecting to this. And the real problem with this actually was more Meese than Dieter, but Dieter at the time was speaking for me, so he's the one that happened to get fired. But it was over the issue of whether Reagan would actually make some decisions that I thought were important here. And how I forced him ultimately to make a decision, he fired me. But I was very happy.
Was Nancy in that period Dieter's defender?
No, not really. Not then. I mean, Nancy. Nancy's quite a person. No, I mean, as a matter of fact, when we were having this out here, why, she's the one that stepped up and said, "Well, I don't see any choice. Mike's got to go." He was sitting right there. But Nancy, you know, was always very loyal to one. You know, he and she were very close in some way. I mean, and I don't mean by saying some way that there was something wrong with it, but they were very close. I'm sure they're two best friends, and closer than that, and really close. They're close to the extent that their children are frozen. But really, because they were so close. And only each of them will really know what the other one's really like. Now, it's not an odd thing. In fact, it's by far the normal thing. The people that get to be president, even those who want it, are actually very much loners. He and she had a lot of friends. But none of them were friends such as you or I would really think of if we were asked to make. Were they people they would confide in? No. They confided in each other. It was the same point you were making about amiability. They had a lot of people they were amiable with.
It's all externalized.
Yeah, right. And it was easy to see, again, when you looked at them, because, again, it's an unnatural thing, as they both have been, to gain their experience in Hollywood, where what you practice is keeping this face on before all members of the public as long and as often as you can, and never breaking them. And they could do that. So they seemed to have a lot of friends. And, frankly, he didn't have any more friends than Richard Nixon. And everybody knew Richard Nixon didn't have.
He didn't have any Bebe Rebosa, did he?
No, he didn't. He didn't. No, that's right. No such person. There have been. Now, people have told me, Jimmy Stewart told me once that before, he wasn't criticizing Nancy for this. He was just commenting on how close they were, that they were consumed by their own relationship. But he was saying that, of course, before Nancy came along, Ron was a close friend of Bill Holden's, but he hadn't seen Bill Holden since they were married. Bill Holden, I can't remember now, it was either Taylor, was his first name. He's a great actor. Good actor.
Robert Taylor.
Good looking guy with a mustache. He had been the best man, and William Holden had been there. The small wedding when Ronald married him. But right away, he didn't see anything, either one of these guys. And as I say, Stewart wasn't saying there's bad or something. He was just commenting on, of course, that they were not used to that.
Did you see enough of the family thing to just again, you don't identify people, I guess, but somebody who was quite close to you said one of the great contradictions of the Reagan presidency was that Reagan and Nancy both taught family values but were total disasters as parents. And Bush was unable to articulate these things, and yet he had a model family. And this person who offered this testimony couldn't quite explain why it was true, but he said he guessed they just had too many other things to do, but they just didn't. He said he, partly being close to Reagan, had made up his mind he was going to spend more time with his children, even if it hurt his profession, because he'd seen what happened with Reagan and Nancy and the children.
I didn't get the impression that it was, at least with their two, that it was a function of time spent there. Again, you can fool a lot of people, not fool them by intending to, but I mean they are fooled by your amiability, but you know, your kids won't put up with being amiable. they know better. They know they expect more. And I don't think they were treated badly or anything. They were just treated amiably. But I don't mean to make fun of it, but it was a sad thing. And it's both their children, and I don't think they necessarily knew this was what they were doing, but they spent most of their time trying to do things so outrageous, most of them weren't that outrageous, but outrageous enough to get the attention of their parents and failing.
There are quotations in this book I'm reading. This book has an explanation I haven't read at all before, this in Ronald Reagan's case, that being a child of an alcoholic, the avoidance of drawing back, and I sense her read that's a fairly, you attribute that with some authority to people, that you avoid conflict and avoid, in a certain sense, avoid emotional.
Well, I think there's a lot to be said for that theory. I'm not an authority in this field, but I mean, there's a lot to be said for that in his case. Evidently, when you've had this experience, a goodly number of people react to it by shutting out reality and living in an amiable circumstances that doesn't involve any emotional attachment.
We're in that chapter here.
Well, that fits him to a T, and it also explains a bit why he could get along so well in the world of movies, and would explain a lot if it's true. She's a much more difficult person to explain. You know, she told me when I first came there that one thing that, I got to know her, I thought, quite well. We weren't always friends, but we were pretty good friends for a time. But certainly true the first go around, and into the second. But she told me originally that one thing that she still really feared, now she had been in movies herself, very good, and she, you know, craved a public life by being in the pictures and then going into this. And I was up there just to talk to her one day, 75, and she still had some misgivings about whether we ought to be doing this, but so I was talking to her, and she said, well, one reason she feared doing it is she'd always been afraid that she'd be somewhere at some public event, some political event, and her real father would just confront her and say, I'm your father. And she just didn't know what she'd do. Won't happen, but I mean, you've already been out here. You know, this is not going to be any different. Actually running for president because of the Secret Service and everything else, you're a little more insulated from this than you would be if you went down to the grocery store. In some respects. So we talked about it for a while, but I found that strange that she would, you know, mention that.
Was the stepfather's political opinions, were they important as transmitted directly or by Nancy, important in moving on away from what a time some of that
maybe, but I don't think so. But you know, what had moved him to write sort of was his exposure to Cordner, Ralph Cordner at the General Electric Company. And there was very clear evidence of that. He personally had done that. And of course, it was the fact he was making a lot of money from the General Electric Company, too.
Tax bill.
Yeah.
Credit back.
Yeah. But that's really the decisive time to change about that.
If it wasn't your father,
I'm very interested. I mean, she had her own opinions, but she never, I don't think, she had strong opinions about the, you know, style, about what was, you know, if you made a use of him that she thought was awful, and she never did this with me, but she did with other people, she would complain about that. Yeah, well, that's right. People sometimes, she had strong opinions about people.
Quick snap.
Yeah, but usually pretty accurate, you know. But as far as issues were concerned or conservative philosophy, she didn't. She found out somewhere, or maybe I told her, Rockefeller. She told me once how much she liked Rockefeller. He was somebody she really thought was, did a lot of things well. You weren't commenting on his beliefs.
From what you know, can you imagine her being the prime motivating factor in the shift on foreign policy?
No. But, I mean, to the extent that some interest in, you know, the concept that, well, it's good if people remember you as a purveyor of peace, but given the opportunity, maybe, but not on the cutting across of, you know, the issues.
Mrs. Carter was here, and she acknowledged that they did talk about politics, and that they did do. She sat in on cabinet. Reagan doesn't fit quite the accent. Did they talk, do you think, a lot about the decisions he had to make?
No. I mean, you got to remember this. He wasn't coming home every night with a bunch of decisions on his hands. for starters. He went to the office and people said, well, this is what you're going to do, and he's, that's one reason he escaped office looking as good as when he got there. He didn't take any, and he never did, about issues, you know. The worst that would happen to him sometimes is she might be discussing, oh, she might be home at night discussing not having, inviting somebody to a White House dinner that he thought should have been. That's what would happen. Well, it is. You see, they were able to see that she had influence. She does have it, but it's not, you know, what you would expect.
One other thing about the relationship that we always, and you may or may not have misread the end of that, but she's supposed to have had a hand in inspiring people, and the theory was that she was not, she could not bring himself to dismiss somebody.
Well, I don't think, you see, some of these are too set to be true, to be frank about. I think myself, and again, this is just a theory, but see, it never made any sense to me, if you want to get into this deeply, that here was this woman, who's a very smart woman, very ambitious woman in her way about the place, how people regarded her, and, you know, quick-witted, impatient. And, you know, okay, most of the world who has seen her and commented on her would agree with that, maybe thinking she had more influence on issues than I do, but so far, I agree with that. And here's Reagan, according to the image, passive, you know, doesn't like to do unpleasant things, not overly ambitious. Nice guy, but nothing to him. Now, I believe in 1978, I attended the celebration of her 25th wedding anniversary, which meant that they had been married since 1950. Might have been 77, so it was 52 or 53. How, if that, those images are true, how did Nancy Reagan, you know, who had no qualms about the divorce, she was married, how did she live with this man? 13 years, 14 years before he got to be governor? She didn't have the patience for that. So there's got to be something more to this, and I really, I don't think he is quite as amiable when it's just the two of them as he appears to everybody else. He's used to putting, he can put this face on all day to everybody. He can't do it for more than 2 weeks. Begins to crack. But he knows that about himself. And I don't think she's as tough or mean, and she isn't as tough. I mean, she's a very insecure person, as she puts out there. So you get down into firings. Well, she always takes the blame for that. Sometimes it's true, she's desperate. But other times, I don't know why it is, but it's convenient. Nancy. It's Nancy. Now, he never does any of them because, again, that would destroy this image. So if somebody else does it, Nancy takes the blame. It's not, you can't be the way it seems. Oh, I saw him from time to time, hit or miss. I never was, I didn't maintain a regular contact. I saw a lot of other people.
Who were you closest to in the administration that worked with Reagan?
Well, the first term, probably Baker. Baker. Second term, I mean, that's part of the question.
You mentioned Jim Lake.
Oh, Well, I could give you other illustrations than I did this morning in terms of how passive he was in terms of running to show you how malleable he was. But I suppose that is the thing that people, even when he first came in, the observers who thought they knew him and the press, they understood he wasn't as hands-on as most people. But nobody ever realized the dimensions of that. They begin to a little more as people come out and discuss it. And that was both a great asset if you were trying to, as I was, trying to manage him, or because you didn't ordinarily, you know, if you were, well, with Nixon, for instance. I had a lot of regard for Nixon's mind. He's a very smart person. And yet, you know, if you were going to give him any advice, you had to sort of make him think he thought of it. And then you could advise him. And you couldn't do that in front of other people either. You had to do that face to face. And once he realized you were doing that, then you'd be in some trouble because then you'd think you understood him. You know, or go around and around like that. Reagan, God, it's a dream. If you were the guy who was giving the advice, he took it. And yet, it was also a very frightening. I mean, even if you were the guy doing it. Not just the thought that somebody else could be. So, you know, those are, and Nixon, God. You know, in the end, Nixon did as he pleased. And sometimes that's what you wanted. I mean, the same thing you wanted. But he'd go out there and do it. And if it didn't happen to be what you wanted, you had to find some way to justify it. Or, I mean, if it was wrong, even. And even if he knew it was wrong, that's still what you had.
You knew Nixon much better.
Yes, absolutely true. Again, I like what you were saying, because my relationship with Reagan was far, far more amiable. But I knew Nixon better. And he wasn't easy to know either. None of these guys were.
Did you have any role in the discussion of the selection of the vice president?
Which time?
Well, either time, either Schweitzer.
First time, yes, I picked that one. Second time, not directly with him, but again, you didn't, you know, you would not have had much impact just talking to him about it anyway. I knew that, indeed that. But I thought of the people that were willing to take, that Bush was the better one. So, and I discussed why with, Casey. They asked.
Are we nearing the point where, given the impact of the media, given the impact of everything else, that to pick a person a heartbeat away who may help you with a couple of states is the wrong criterion to follow? Close enough to the point where we are.
Well, I don't know that anymore we even are picking guys who will help you with a state or two. We're not even meeting that criteria anymore.
Well, they don't need a state or two these days.
Well, you know. I mean, I'm not here to dump on Danny Quayle, but I mean, that didn't make any sense from any standpoint.
Were we?
Well, that's hard for me to believe, and I like Jim a lot, but it's hard for me to believe.
He said he was out in the crowd when they came up with the river.
Well, if that's true, he should have gone back in there and really been upset, because and do those things without you there. I don't notice that he said he complained about it, but so that's why I tend not to believe that he really didn't.
Is any change possible in the way we pick vice presidents?
I doubt it. You know, I suppose it's too much to ask people to conform to some, you know, credible level of qualification. And I suppose that's a little hollow since we don't require that out of our presidential nominees anymore. But I mean, that's in this day and age what you need more than anything else, but there's no way to compel it. And unfortunately, what happens, and it doesn't happen every time, but what happens more and more is they're just picking guys who they're sure will not, you know, outshine it. They'll make you look good, which means somebody worse than you.
Impeachment insurance.
Sort of, yes. Health insurance.
I've got to go. Enjoyed seeing you.
Oh, no. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Kept it in. Anybody else? We, at the very least, ought to take a break, but maybe we should think about imposing.
Now, Nixon is a very interesting man for us. Reagan's a little, you know, one-dimensional once you get on. Nixon.
Which Nixon?
Oh, pick anyone you want. There were thousands, actually. I'll just throw you a few one-liners. Going up the steps, I was with him once, of the Mormon Temple in Salt Lake City. We just held a rally down, this was in 66, at the foot of this temple. It was noontime. The band was playing. All these people were watching us sort of ascending, in their view, to heaven. Going in to see the counselor, whatever they call it, of the Mormon Church, the highest, the elders. Get halfway up the steps. He stops, turns to me, and he says, "John." I said, "Yeah." He said, "Whatever I say in here, don't you believe a word of it." Now that's a real human being.
Yeah. I can match that, I think. I was the lowliest of the assistant mm-hmm. professors at Northwestern one time, 52.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a group which really did honestly try to be bipartisan, mm-hmm. the Independent Voters of Illinois, mm-hmm. but they were affiliated with the ADA in New York. Washington, and ADA didn't want to send anybody to the Republican convention, mm-hmm. so this Independent Voters of Illinois sent me to testify for the platform committee. And I stayed up all night, and I worked on this paper, and the title would have appealed to Nixon. It was Confrontation versus mm-hmm. Negotiation. Mm-hmm. Senator Milliken, when I came in, said, "Now, Professor, just give us that blankety-blank paper." He said, "You're just as likely to get notice giving us the paper as you are by reading the goddamn thing." But I've been working too hard, and I read every last word of it, and everybody on the committee slept except Nixon and Ives.
Uh-huh.
And Nixon said, "Now, Professor, on the basis of your long experience, would you say that such and such?" And this was the greatest paper he had heard on Soviet-American relations, and he wanted 50 copies, and you can imagine the assistant professor just floating up in the ceiling. But I'd come early, uh-huh. and I heard him do the same thing with Merman Gray Hart, who was the worst anti-Semite. And I stood at the door and I heard him
do it. You're not supposed to do that.
Stood at the door and heard him do it with Clark Eichelberger for World Government.
That's a real politician.
Yeah.
Well, in 52, I guess.
Yeah.
How well did Reagan understand himself? I heard an interesting story from one of our alumni, Charles McDowell, at a reporter. He met Reagan in a social setting. He said, "I went to school in Lexington, and by the way, one of the big thrills of my life was to see you make the movie Brother Rat, and I went over and watched the set for mm-hmm. 3 or 4 days. And Reagan told him, "Well, I wasn't there. That was all shot in Hollywood. That was the extra. They just did some long shots." and we made it all in the studio. And McDowell said, well, Mr. President, you ruined one of my favorite stories. I tell everybody I know that I saw you when you were an actor. And Reagan's response was, well, don't stop telling them. It's a good story.
Yeah.
I do that all the time.
Just being honest.
I do that all
he
the
said,
time.
He said, I do that all the time.
Yeah, that's true. Well, you know, I used to tell people who were going to have to deal with him that, you know, didn't know him very well, that because, you see, if you didn't know him, there was this first phase where you'd become impressed with, hey, this guy's a nice guy, really, and I thought he probably wasn't, or he was strange or something. He's a pretty nice guy. He talks about baseball.